I always went to the town I was supposed to go first, without really thinking about it. I'd know before I started where I was supposed to go, but I never had to correct myself to think, oh, I'm supposed to go to Klamath, not Craig, or something like that.
Our guest is Bob Ellis, and of course he's the founder of Ellis Airlines that later merged with Coastal and then with Alaska Airlines. And although retired now, he's a member of the board of Alaska Airlines and one of the great names in Alaska aviation, pioneering in particular Southeastern aviation. And I came on the Alaska scene while we still had what it was called Coastal Ellis.
Yes.
While we still had that, you hadn't merged with Alaska Airlines yet. And we still had the Grumman Goose. I guess they still do, don't they?
Well, they're still, Alaska Airlines doesn't have any Grumman Gooses, but they're still flying in Southeastern.
Let's go to what our listeners like for us to do and to the start of it all and trace your career in aviation and the other things you've done, Bob. Where were you born?
In Vermont some time ago, 1903.
I love Alaska, but Vermont would be a tough state to leave. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Well, I was only 16, and I was sort of glad to leave. I wanted to get out of the quiet state of Vermont. It's just for the older people.
That's right. It's kind of pastoral, isn't it?
Yes.
With the Holstein cows going across the dirt road. That's what lured you this way, then?
Yes.
The lure of excitement?
Well, I wanted to go west, and I came as far as Seattle and stopped off a few years and then came on to Alaska.
How did you get started in flying prior to coming to Alaska?
Yes. I learned to fly with the Navy in Seattle, Naval Reserve in Seattle, in 1927. And in 1929, I had my license. And I had a job. At that time, if you had a license, there were so few pilots, you could usually get a job. Not necessarily a good job, but you could get a job.
But if you were working as a pilot, then you made good money, didn't you?
Yes. Actually, in 1930, we were getting $500 a month base pay and $5 an hour. And it wasn't at all unusual. You could get in $100 a month, $625 a month. And I think there's some pilots today that aren't making that much.
Right. Well, now that was really good money.
It was great money for the
early 30s then.
Yeah. It didn't last all year. We just flew in the summer months. And we shut down in the winter for the first few winters. In 1936, I started flying all winter.
You were in Seattle, let's cover Seattle just a little bit better than that and then bring you to Alaska.
Oh, well, I was in Seattle and I had my first job in aviation at Bryn Mawr Airport, and Ansel Eichmann was getting ready to fly from Seattle to Juneau, a nonstop flight in a Lockheed Vig airplane. And Ansel...
Had that been done before?
No, this was to be the first flight. And Ansel was an awfully good pilot, but not a very good navigator, and he'd hired some fellow to work out his navigation. And this person didn't really know how to navigate, and Ansel had me checking over his figures, and I quickly exposed him. And so Ansel then said, well, I'm not taking him. So then I went over his notes again and made it look more difficult and suggested he take me. And he says, okay. He says, I won't pay any money. I'll pay your expenses. Well, it was fine with me. And the next night I was in Juneau.
And this was the first nonstop from Seattle to Juneau. How long did it take you?
7 hours and 35 minutes.
Uneventful?
Yes, uneventful. Of course, it was exciting for us.
Sure.
Because we didn't have good weather all the way, particularly on the British Columbia coast. Well, we kept going, and we never stopped, and we pass Ketchikan, circle Ketchikan, circle Wrangell, and circle Juneau, and it was a great sight coming into Petersburg, I mean. It was a great sight coming into Juneau. It was a beautiful day then, and when a beautiful day in Juneau on April 15th, it looked good.
Sonny?
Yes?
We've had a number of people from Juneau on the show here, and of course Juneau is fighting once again to keep the capital there. And I forget who we had most recently. Maybe it was Bill Wally. Anyway, Sonny has often commented about how scary it is, as far as she's concerned, flying into Juneau. And we're talking with a man tonight who probably knows as much about flying in Southeastern as any person possibly could. In your book, Bob, What No Landing Field, you explained how, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, you explained how you navigated, how you flew when the conditions were bad, and you really couldn't go by instruments.
Well, we flew low, and it was really low. I don't mean even 100 feet, but sometimes we would be right down to 5 or 10 feet off the water. And if the water was at all smooth and they got real tough, you could just creep the throttle back a little bit and you'd be on the water. Maybe I should make a point right now is that in Southeastern, we flew seaplanes exclusively. We did a land plane down there even today is quite a sight. People run outdoors and point. And there definitely weren't any land planes in those days.
So when it got especially soupy, you laid it close to the water, like
yes.
5 feet.
Yes.
When you came into Juneau that first time, incidentally, where do you live now, Bob?
I live in Ketchikan.
When you landed in Juneau that first time, did you have any feel that you were going to stay in Alaska?
I think at that age, you don't look very far ahead. You just look ahead at the most a day or two. But I certainly liked it, and I didn't ever make any plans to go anywhere else.
How did the people in Juneau feel that day? Were they aware that you and Alec, was it? What was his name?
Ansel Eichmann.
Had made it nonstop for the first time from Seattle?
Oh, it was great. There were three of us on the plane. There was a mechanic by the name of Jack Halloran as well. And we were heroes, really. For 2-3 days there, you couldn't buy a meal in a restaurant or anything else. People wanted to treat you. And we had some newspapers, PI newspapers, that day's newspapers. And it was the first time in Alaska that they ever had today's newspapers today. And we brought some milk, not for publicity. We just had milk aboard to drink ourselves. And we had a quart of that left over, and we gave it to someone, and they put it up in a window with a label, Seattle Milk. Even refrigeration in those days couldn't get Seattle Milk to get to Juneau.
What was the next thing that happened to you?
Well, that summer I flew around with Eichmann and some of the other pilots as a navigator. This is 1929.
Now, who were you working for?
Well, I was working for Alaska Washington Airways. And I was getting expenses and a little extra spending money, but I wasn't formally a pilot until the following spring. And when I started flying around Seattle to Seattle, Victoria, Seattle, Vancouver.
And for Alaska, Washington.
Yes. And then in the spring, I came north to lived in Juneau for 2 years.
What was the fate of Alaska, Washington Airlines?
Well, we made a lot of money in Alaska, and they spent it all down on Puget Sound, and they eventually went broke.
It disappeared entirely.
Yes.
Our guest is Bob Ellis, and he's the founder of Ellis Airlines, and he later merged with Coastal Ellis, and then with Alaska Airlines. And Sonny, you flew this Seattle to Juneau nonstop in a Lockheed Vega?
Yes.
What kind of plane was it?
Oh, it was a real good plane. In fact, even today it would be a good plane. Unfortunately, it was all wood, plywood. But by a then new process of molding plywood, and the fuselage was the one of the first monocoque fuselage. The other pilots who didn't have this kind of airplane always referred to it as the hollow log. But it was fast, and it would pack a good load, but it didn't stand up awfully well.
You're going to find out before we go much farther with the show that I don't know that much about aviation. However, but by monocoque, you probably mean just one hole in the top of it rather than two.
No, I meant that it was...
C-A-U-L-K, don't you?
I mean it was like a hollow log, that it was like a cylinder, a tapered cylinder. And it's the kind that Wiley Post flew around the world, and the kind of Jimmy Madden and Roscoe Turner and Amelia Earhart and a lot of the prominent pilots of that day flew the Lockheed Vega.
What kind of plane was it in Alaska?
Well, on floats it was a good plane. The fuselage was small, but it would carry everything you could put into it. Take six passengers plus the pilot.
Now, let's see. I'm looking at one. I have a picture of one in your book here, and like this one here.
Yes, like that one there. It's a high wing.
We saw those in use in Alaska until how long, Bob?
I think Shel Simmons was flying one around Juneau up until 10 years ago. At a Shel Simmons Alpha Alaska Coastal Airlines. Hans Burrow used to fly one up here in and out of Fairbanks. And there's been more than one, I'm sure, in the Fairbanks area over the years, but I don't think you've seen any much in the last 15 years.
When you were getting started in Juneau and you had flown up in a Lockheed Vega, How new were floats for aircraft?
They weren't new at all. In fact, right from the start of aviation, why the designers were first putting airplanes on wheels and then on floats and on wheels, trying to find a proper kind of a landing gear. So they weren't new. The floats weren't awfully good. Used to have to fight leaks. In fact, at one time I had a flight mechanic that used to sleep in the airplane and with an alarm clock and woke up every 2 hours to pump the floats until we could get time enough to beach it somewhere and repair it. So that's the way it went.
Was there any place in the United States where float planes were used as much or as commonly as in Southeastern?
Well, they were pretty common in Anchorage and Fairbanks area before you got fuels here. In fact, when I flew out of Anchorage, we flew a float plane, a Fairchild float plane, and they were flying float planes out of Fairbanks here at that time, going up and down the rivers in the summertime.
Was there any development in floats that would be important for us to toss into the show tonight?
Well, only in recent years they've developed floats with amphibious gear so that you can, the Edo people have a float job. It goes on most any airplane. They have it in various sizes. And it has wheels that lower down through the floats and you can land on the field. They work pretty good.
Was it one of the early pioneers on floats?
Edo was one of the early pioneers on floats, and they are still at it.
What came next then, Bob? We've got you down in Juneau and in Vancouver and Seattle.
Oh, well, I worked when Alaska Washington went broke. Well, I got a job with Alaskan Airlines and came up to Anchorage and flew out of Anchorage for several months.
Who was Alaska Airlines then?
Well, it was
Alaskan.
Actually, it was Alaskan Airways. And that was a subsidiary of American Airways, and they had nothing to do with the Alaska Airlines as we know it today. And it was a, this outfit had bought up several of the local airplane owners around here and consolidated them in this one outfit. There was Joe Carson and Ed Young and Robbins and Gillum and some of those people that were the pilots of it.
With Alaskan Airways?
Yes.
Any
Matt Niemenham was in Anchorage.
Any experiences you recall from that period with Alaskan Airways?
Well, I'd like to pay a little tribute to Matt Niemenham for one thing. He was not a very warm personality, but he certainly was a crackerjack pilot. And he broke me in down at Anchorage, took me out over the Rainy Pass, you know, the same route that the dog teams took this last few weeks. And as we went along, why, every time we'd pass one of these abandoned roadhouses, he'd roll the plane over and point it out. And I think, well, what's he doing that for? But I found out later why he was doing it, that those were the only semi-habitations on the whole route from there out to the Kuskokwim. And Matt was sure great. He could fly over a place. You know, you found your field after you got there, depending on how the snow and the snow cover was and how what the wind had done to the drifts and so forth. But he'd fly by just once, take that one look, and do a half turn, come in and land. He always landed right where he wanted to, and he never had any trouble. He still was a great pilot.
Who was the first? Was he the first pilot to really make an impression on you as a young man up here in Alaska?
Well, I've been flying out of Juneau, you see, for 3 years then, so he wasn't the first, but he was probably the first in this area, when I say to the westward. I had met Joe Carson and Robbie, we call him, and Ed Young, and they were all three of those crackerjack pilots, too.
Was there anyone working out of Juneau while you were there who was particularly good?
The first 2 years I was there, I was the only pilot.
In
Juneau.
Period.
Yeah.
How big was Juneau then?
Oh, 5,000 maybe. So there weren't many pilots around. Gene Meyering was flying out of Ketchikan. And see, I don't remember anybody else that was in Southeastern in 1930 other than Ekman, who would have appeared from time to time and do a little flying, but they were still trying to fly down it out of Seattle to Victoria, Vancouver, and other routes.
Was any airline flying in and out of Juneau then?
No.
Everything was boat?
Yeah. And everything was charter operation. There was no schedule. In fact, we didn't even have a single fare set up as it had some places now, you know, where it's $35 and the two fare minimum or something like that. It was strictly so much an hour. And I don't remember now, but I think it was $60 an hour that we got for the airplanes then. And if somebody came along and wanted to go to Sitka, well, who else you got? Pretty soon you'd have enough together to pay for, to write up the money and pay for the trip.
Anything else from Anchorage during your period of time there? How long were you in Anchorage?
Well, I wasn't there very long. In fact, I didn't like the flying out of there. And so I left and went back to Southeastern in the seaplanes and the rain and things like that.
And who did you join next?
I joined Alaska Southern Airways, who had bought the equipment of Alaska Washington Airways. And Alaska Southern Airways was owned by Nick Bez, a cannery an operator, a fishing cannery operator.
Sorry?
Why didn't you like flying out of Anchorage?
It was a pretty tough flying, really. I guess that's why I didn't like it. And flying across Alaska Range in those days was no treat. Some of the trips we went flew down the Kuskokwim as far as Bethel, then cut cross country over to Bristol Bay and made the stops over there, and then came back to Anchorage, and it was a long, tiresome trip with no radio communications. And, this wasn't my bag, as they say nowadays.
I read in your book, I think, about a run that you made with some improbable names you had to pronounce. Can you do that again?
Well, those places are still there. You'd leave Anchorage and go down past Chagunadak Volcano. I think that was it. Anyhow, you landed at the first place you landed was Nishigak, and across the bay to Naknek and Igikik and Kogiung and places like that.
You mentioned one that you didn't have to stop at. It's what, Nanva?
Nanva Galaklak. I guess that's still a place. I think they have a kind of a trading post or something there.
In broadcasting, you can tell someone who's just arrived on the scene in Alaska very easily because he begins to butcher the names of the villages, you know. And even after you've been here for a while, they're really difficult to do. You had another one here, Kanakanak?
Kanakanak.
Kanakanak.
Yeah. Or you can pronounce it Kanakanak. I should think down there they more likely to say Kanakanak.
Back to Alaska Southern Airways, tell us some of your experiences with it.
I think Alaska Southern Airways, that was the time when I went to flew to Nome to meet Jimmy Mattern, who was attempting to fly around the world. And he had landed over in Russia, and the Russians brought him to Nome in this big flying boat, twin-engine flying boat, which was quite an experience.
Well, now, Mattern, how famous a name was he in aviation?
Well, he was almost as famous as Wild Post, except that he didn't make it. But he was flying around the world a few days ahead of Wiley Post, and both of them, in a sense, racing each other. And he was doing real good. In fact, I think he went up to the time he cracked up, I think he was doing as good as Wiley Post. But then his engine began using a lot of oil, and they put in a special tank so he could cross over to Nome, somewhere back there in Russia or Siberia. When he came to pump the oil into the regular tank, it was so cold it wouldn't move. So he elected to land in the tundra rather than risk having the engine come apart somewhere.
He didn't crash as such then?
Well, it was an intentional landing, but he sure busted the airplane up pretty badly, and he was unreported for several days. He was still in Russia when Wiley Post passed Nome and came through this country.
How did you get involved with Mattern then?
Well, it isn't a short story, but I'll make it as fast as I can. There was a beer brewer in New York City that was anxious to get a little notoriety, and he sponsored the Mattern Relief Expedition, and they had a...
Which one do you remember?
The brewer?
Uh-huh.
No, I don't. And probably is... We never did get all our money either. But
that's probably just as well you don't remember.
Maybe that's why I don't remember.
The breweries of that period were always doing something like this, weren't they? And there were great races that they sponsored.
Well, this is our first realization that they weren't always as prompt in their payments. But anyhow, this Madden relief expedition, consisting of a blank airplane with a J-5 engine on it, had tremendous range. It wasn't very fast, but it had tremendous range because it was just a 225 engine, and they could go sail off for, I don't know, 8 or 9 hours. And there was a pilot and a co-pilot and another guy who could supposed to be able to repair airframes, and a fourth guy who was a mechanic. And they set out to go to Siberia to find Madden. Madden was still unreported. And they got as far as Edmonton. They left Edmonton and were going to go to Prince Rupert. And they showed that Prince Rupert had an airport because the letters on the map were pretty big. And the biggest flat place at Rupert was the tennis court. So they turned around and went back up the river, and they saw a farmer's field at Terrace, and they landed in the farmer's field. And I think about that time they decided that they voted no confidence in the pilot. And some of them, three of them got on a speeder, on the railroad, and came down, no road in those days, just came down the railroad, and they had a wreck on the way down. And one fellow was hurt, so they left him to recuperate. And a Canadian Junkers plane came by, and they bummed a ride to Juneau. And they made this deal to fly to Siberia. Just about this time, Madden's reported at Anadyr, Siberia. Anadyr, some people say. So they made this deal with Cot Hayes to fly to Siberia, pick up Madden, bring him all the way back to the U.S., I guess.
Who was Cot Hayes?
Well, he's a lot of people know him because he spent many years as manager for Northwest in Anchorage. He's a great Alaskan. And he was in aviation from 1929 on, ever since I knew, since I was in aviation.
And he was with you with Alaska Southern?
Yes, he was with Alaska Washington. He was with Alaska Southern. And then he went to work for Northwest. But he made this deal, and the first time I went, it was a rainy day in Ketchikan, and I got this telegram, go to Prince Rupert, pick up Thomas Abbey, and bring him to Juneau. So I did. And when I got to Juneau, I said to Cot, what's up? He said, you're going to Siberia in the morning. Well, great news. I haven't even got a map. Well, these guys got a map. And so then we talked with these guys. Where's your map? Well, they had an Alaska steamship map of Alaska, which was just about as big as a half a newspaper. And but I scouted around Juneau and I found the map. In the meantime, while there were telegrams going back and forth to New York City, and the guy in New York City, the money will be deposited tomorrow. So we left, 4 o'clock in the morning. That night we were in Nome. And I still feel kind of smug about that, because that was quite a flight in 1934.
You departed where?
We departed Juneau.
In the morning.
In the morning, and by 5 o'clock that night, we're in Nome. And part of the trip, we didn't even have a map, but Joe Crossan had told me, well, once you pass the Canadian border, if you get in the Tanmel Valley, you can't get lost. And he was right, because we just stayed in the valley, and after a while, it seemed like a long while, too. We saw Fairbanks, then we got another map.
Was this your first flight from Juneau to Nome?
Yes. And we got gas in Fairbanks, and then we gassed again at Ruby, and And we were known that night. But no, but Mattern is still in Siberia. And the U.S. State Department was supposedly trying to make arrangements for us to go to Siberia and pick them up. But they hadn't got permission. And so we just hung around Nome for several days, and eventually the Russians brought them over in this, it was a great plane. It was, looked like a German Dornier flying boat of that vintage. But two great big engines in tandem up on top of the wing, one pushing and one pulling. The mechanic sat between the two engines. So we had quite a visitation with them in Nome. And the reason we stayed those extra few days was to get some money. I wasn't about to start back until they came through with some money. Well, finally, they did get some money, and they gave me $500, and I said, well, I'll take you as far as Juneau. And I did, and I think in Juneau we got maybe another $500. And I was to take them as far as Terrace, where their plane was.
And Terrace was in
British Columbia, just east of Prince Rupert. And Jimmy Mattern took a look at the farmer's field and said, gee, will you take them up to Hazleton? He said, I don't think I can take all these guys off this field. So we went, flew to Hazleton, landed in the river there, right alongside a field. The hay in the field was, gosh, almost as high as your shoulder. And by that time, we're getting pretty famous, and the people of Hazleton had set out two barrels of free gasoline for us. And Will Sassine was my flight mech at that time, and we were pumping the gas into the airplane, and Mattern was made one pass to take off from the field, cut the gun, couldn't make it. And Sassine and I said we both said to each other, fooey for the free gas, let's get out of here, before they want us to go to Edmonton. So we took off and circled back, and Mattern was just making a second pass, and he just cleared the end of the field. You see, he had five guys in this airplane by this time. He just cleared the edge of the field, and he went on down the canyon there for about 5 miles before he could turn around and head east, but he made it all right. He's a good pilot.
Do you recall anything that happened to Mattern after that? Or did he become obscure? Of course, we all know the name of the post, but like you say, Mattern.
Well, he kept flying. He kept flying for many years, but no more spectaculars, as far as I know. But I think he was gainfully employed because he was a good pilot. There's no doubt about that.
Did you ever have the urge to go around the world, anything like that?
Oh, I've always had the urge to make long flights from A to B, but I never...
Not all the way back to A again.
I think it's the kind of an urge that everybody has, whether it's you exercise it or not. Hardly a man that living that wouldn't like to sail around the world.
You said sail. You lived on a yacht for... Do you still live on a yacht?
No. We moved ashore a couple of years ago, and now we're living on an island. We still got water all around us, but so we're living on an island right near Ketchikan.
We're jumping too far ahead now. Our guest is Bob Ellis. He founded Ellis Airlines. It later merged with Alaska Coastal as Coastal Ellis, and then that merged with Alaska Airlines. Bob is a member of the board of directors of Alaska Airlines and visiting in Fairbanks, and we're privileged to have him with us on the show tonight and have him reminisce with us. What came after Alaska Southern, Bob?
Well, then...
This was incidentally in 1933-34.
Yes.
I was just getting my start then, Bob.
Well, in the fall of 1934... Nick Bez sold Alaska Southern to Pacific Alaska, which was a subsidiary of PAA, and who had been operating in the Fairbanks area for 2-3 years, and they had decided to move into Southeastern. And they operated the summer of 35, and then started to operate in the spring of 36, and then changed her mind again and canceled it all. And I like to sort of boast that I was hired and fired 4 times in 1 year by Pan American. That's when I started Ellis Airlines.
Pacific Alaska Airways was a subsidiary of Pan Am?
Yes, yes.
PAA remained in Alaska for a long time, didn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. They never really got out of Alaska because in 1937, they started flying Juneau, Seattle with a twin-engine Sikorsky amphibian. And then in 38, they bumped it up to flying a four-engine Sikorsky flying boat that could pack, I don't know, 25, 30 passengers. And they would fly 2 or 3 times a week during the summer.
What happened to PAA eventually?
Well, they, we had a war. And they got busy on other things. They were flying, they were getting into the DC-3s about that time, and they temporarily abandoned the commercial Seattle, Alaska flights, but then they began flying the regular flights. The field at Annette was constructed, and the field at Juneau was enlarged. The original field at Juneau was only 2,000 feet, and it wasn't fit for DC-3s or something like that.
Well, did PAA go out of business, or was it? Did it eventually merge with somebody? Do you recall?
No, they didn't. They just failed. PA doesn't go out of business. They just phase out some of the operations to start something else. And the war gave them the opportunity to carry freight and military passengers up and down the coast.
Well, I mean specific, not Pan Am, but specific Alaska Airways, that aspect of it. Did it faded from the scene after the war?
I think it faded from the scene just about the start of the war. I can't remember them... I can't remember them doing anything in 42, say.
Well, yeah, you left them for what reason?
Oh, I was fired.
Why were you fired, Bob?
Well, because they decided not to operate in Southeastern anymore.
And you decided to go into business for yourself.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I was getting tired of... getting tired of out-of-state ownership and bosses. That was the thing to do in those days. Everybody was doing it. Practically every of our early-day aviators ended up as individual bush pilots in their own business. Like Ray Peterson, Bob Reed, Noel Ream, Sig Ream, they were all doing their own flying to start with, and pretty soon they had 2 pilots and 3 pilots and 4 pilots and planes to go with them. That's the way everything grew up here.
There was a strong desire for a man to be in business for himself, and I don't think it's nearly as strong today, and I have the feeling, you know, I like a desire to be my own boss and to create something where there was nothing and cause something to grow. What did you have? Tell us about how you started, Ellis.
I borrowed some money, $4,000 in fact.
And this was 36?
And bought a Walker for something like $6,800 balance when I got it. And that was the way I got started.
In 36?
In 36.
Tell us a little bit about the Waco.
It's a biplane with a Jacobs engine. Carried 4 people, the pilot and 3 passengers. And it was a handy little airplane. It wasn't at all sturdy by present-day standards, but it made me my first million, as it were. That is, I managed to pay for it.
This was in Ketchikan?
Yes.
Well, why did you pick Ketchikan?
There wasn't anybody else there at the time.
Well, there probably weren't too many.
There was a vacuum.
Wow. How about Juneau?
Well, Shel Simmons had just started up with Stinson on floats there, and so that sort of was monopolizing the business there. And Ketchikan was a vacuum, so I started there.
Was there any strip at Ketchikan?
No.
Was the one on Annette Island there yet?
No, that wasn't started until 1940.
And then you were strictly amphibious, and what was most of your work there initially?
People. There never was a great freight movement down there like there is here. Mostly people.
To and from?
Craig, Lot, Heidelberg, logging camps, fish buying stations, Wrangell, Petersburg. Maybe once or twice a week you'd have a trip to Juneau. Once in a while up to Sitka.
You were paying off your WACO. Was business good from the start?
Yes. In fact, I think I made as much money the first year as I did the last year.
What was your next step in growth after the WACO?
Well, then we bought another WACO. Then we bought a Blanca. And another Blanca. And by the start of the war, we had 6 airplanes, including a Stinson, 3 Blancas, 2 Walkers. But then we got we struggled through the war with those airplanes, and after the war, the Grumman Goose became surplus, and we started buying those as fast as we could buy one. As soon as we get a little more money, we start looking around for another airplane. We had 8 airplanes, 8 Grumman Goose, and 1 PBY at the time of the merger with Coastal. And they had 7 Grumman Gooses and 2 PBYs and a couple of single engine planes.
That logo of the 2 geese, was that yours or Coastal's?
That was ours.
Who did that? Where'd that come from? Because that stands out in the minds of many people.
I think maybe Jack Sherman, our chief mechanic, could be responsible for it. We tried several designs, and it just kind of evolved. I imagine that you might find as many as 6 people who will claim they designed it.
It's a very well-known design in Alaska aviation, I guess. Mm-hmm. Tell us about Ansel right now before we move on with some more development of the story.
Well, Ansel Ekman was the pilot on my first flight to Alaska. I was the navigator. And Ansel was a World War I pilot, crackerjack pilot. But he managed to skip at least one course in ground school. And he never did become very familiar with a compass. And in the 20s, he used to fly this old Boeing B-1E flying boat from Seattle to Victoria to meet the steamers coming over from the Orient and bring the mail back to Seattle, thereby saving a whole day. And he was the original on fly low, slow, and be careful. And so that was the way he flew Puget Sound. One day he was chugging along, it was real foggy, and the battleship loomed up, and he landed, and the battleship put an anchor waiting for the fog to clear. They couldn't make it, so he's called up, shut off his engine, called up, which way is Seattle? And they figured it out and came back and said, well, it's south, southeast, the quarter east. He says, don't tell me that, just point. And Ansel used to tell his story on himself quite a bit, but as a further tribute to his ability, they did point, and he did take off, and he did get to Seattle, and that was the way he used to do it.
The way I am with directions. People say it's south of Cushman or west of Noble or something like that, and I say, just tell me what it's next to, you know.
I'm going to ruin her political career, Bob. She's on the borough assembly here.
Oh, I see.
And she does good work. I'll concede that, and she's a good member of the assembly, and I'm proud of her and all that. But she doesn't really know where her burrow is, north, south, east, and west. And, you'd never make it as a pilot, I'll tell you that.
Oh, I know.
Whatever happened to Ansel Eckman?
Well, he died in bed a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago.
Did he stay in Alaska? Or?
No, he started a resort on Orcas Island down in Puget Sound and did very well. He's a wonderful piano player, had a million friends, and I guess that people just love to go up to Orcas Island and stay at his resort and drink his booze and hear him play the piano, and he was a great guy.
Do you ever get philosophical about things occasionally, Bob?
I suppose, yeah.
Well, everything I know about you is that you have always been friendly with people, haven't you?
Yes. That is, I like people.
Has that been a very important part of your life? You know, this just being in a good mood and friendly?
Well, I don't know that I've been philosophical enough to analyze myself in that respect. But it's, I suppose, yeah.
Well, I wonder why you do it. For example, every once in a while I have really, or by way of explanation, I should say, every once in a while I start to think about myself and my attitudes, and I'm an intolerant devil, and I'll shout and get angry and all that stuff. And in the big scheme of things, what I'm shouting and getting angry about isn't really that important, and I haven't made it through this portion of my life being reasonably even tempered, and you have a rather full life of being that way, as I understand it, and that's, I just ask.
Oh. Well, perhaps you should ask someone who knows me better, like say my wife, whether I'm philosophical and placid and bucolic and even-tempered. And
How would you describe yourself?
Well, I think I'm a great guy.
Well, apparently I'm not going to get too far with that. Well, let's cover a few more of the pilots you mentioned. We always ask, when we have someone like you on, Bob, present company excluded, who was the greatest bush pilot you knew?
Well, every pilot had certain qualities, and they differed quite a bit. Joe Carson was a great pilot, and he's so famous around Fairbanks, at least with the older people, that you cannot say too much about him. I could tell you something about Joe's flying ability. I was at Juneau in the winter of 1934-35 at the airport, and we had about four, and he had landed with a Lockheed twin-engine Electra, one of the old Electras, which is a small 8-passenger job, twin-engine. And about 4 inches of snow fell during the night. We had no snowplow. Joe said, "Oh, well, we'll make it," and he taxied out, and we only had 2,000 foot fuel. We made one run down the field and couldn't get up enough speed to take off. He turned around and made another run back and still couldn't make it. And the third run, he got off. But each run he made, he was blowing snow out of his wheel tracks. And I went out later, and you couldn't tell that there'd been more than one pass, except for the way he turned around. And I've tried it since, take a Grumman Goose and lay one wheel on the yellow line going down the runway and try and keep it there, and I can't do it. But he did it three times there with this. So he was a good pilot. Gillum was probably the first of the instrument pilots. I think probably Gillum did more, spectacular work in the eyes of the other pilots with his instrument flying. Jack Jeffords with the FAA in Anchorage was equally good, but Gillum's was commercial and Jefford was with the FAA. But they were both crackerjack instrument pilots when the rest of us were just fumbling our way around and getting them to get out and pull up in the soup and sit there long enough to figure where he was. Come down, and he did pretty good until the engine quit on him down near Ketchikan one day in a snowstorm. And he got down all right, but then he starved to death before they found him.
Any other anecdotes about pilots you've known, Bob?
Well, Shel Simmons is a very good friend of mine, and one of his exploits is not very, at all well known. There was a coaster vessel ran aground up north of Latuya Bay one year with about 12 people on it. And they, it was a sandy beach up there. They were able to all get ashore, but two of them couldn't walk. One was sick, I guess, one was injured. I forgot what it was. And there they sat, and at the mouth of this small river. And there was no, the ocean was there, but big swells, you couldn't land a seaplane. There were no landplanes in the area. Simmons went out one day and took a look at it and figured out, well, what he could do. So the next day he went back right at high tide. And he landed virtually in the ocean on a crest of a wave as it was going into this little estuary, and rode it on in, picked up the sick guy and the injured guy, took off. He wouldn't go back again. He said, let the other guys walk out. But I think it was a great exploit in figuring out what to do, having the courage to try it, and then do it right. And I like to tell the story to those that want to listen.
How about one of yours? What perhaps might have been your closest call?
Well, there's the old gag about airline pilots. It's hours and hours of boredom was punctuated by brief periods of panic. I think that the most harrowing experience I had was during the war, and I was flying this somewhat decrepit carrier plane from Sitka to Kodiak. And I'd come up the coast from Sitka and stayed overnight at Anchorage. And the next morning, started for Kodiak. And first I went up on top, but I couldn't get any radio signal out of Kodiak to pick up the range. So then I went down underneath. And I immediately ran into heavy snow. This is right about Saldovia. So I came back, went up on top, and I thought, well, I'll push on for a ways. And I pushed on for a ways, and I got to the Barren Islands. Still no radio signal. So I thought, I'll go down underneath again. There's a big hole there, and I could see the Barren Islands. So I went down, and I was chugging along underneath. And there's nothing to run into there for quite a ways, and so I wasn't worried about the snow. But the scoop, my carburetor scoop, started filling up with snow. And I kept pushing the throttle ahead. And I had read the book before I left, but I guess I hadn't read it well enough. And it was a non-icing carburetor. And the engine kept slowing down, and I kept pushing on the throttle and trying to get more power out of it. And finally, I was headed into the wind. I was right down over the water, and I thought, this is it. I'm going to have to land, out of sight of land. And I remembered, the scoop may fill up with snow, and if it does, pull the alternate air. And where is the alternate air? And I looked all around, and I found it. And I pulled the alternate air, and that engine, and it turned up about 90% power. And I straightened out of my course for Kodiak. And I couldn't slow the engine down then. Couldn't move the throttle. It was frozen tight. So I came roaring in, and eventually we ran out of the snow and picked up a fog neck island. And I came roaring into Kodiak on about 90% power. And I maneuvered so I got in a good position over the runway and cut the switch and came sailing in quiet like, landed on the runway. Let it roll off to the side of the runway. Now I should discuss it with that airplane. I just picked my suitcase out of it and went over to the quarters and called them up and said, come and get it.
What did you do during the war, Bob?
Well, I was, plus I've been affiliated with the Navy for practically all my life. They taught me most of what I know.
For those who joined us late, you got your first training as an aviator in the Navy.
Yes. And so I was called to active duty in April 1941, before the real action started. And I was at Sitka for the start of the war. And then I joined a scouting squadron that was based at Sitka, became the executive officer, and eventually the commanding officer of this squadron. Then we moved to Kodiak. And when my tour of duty, as it were, was up, then I was transferred to Naval Air Station Kodiak as executive officer. And I was there over a year. Then I went to Attu as executive officer, and eventually as commanding officer. So I had really good duty all during the war. It was the effort I was making was nothing to be ashamed of, and at the same time nobody was shooting at me, which was some comfort.
But people thought that that's where the shooting might come.
Well, by the time I got there too, the shooting was all over.
Yeah. When you were at Kodiak, President Roosevelt came through, didn't he?
Yes. Yes.
You recall anything from that?
Well, it was, of course, a big event. And most people, hardly anybody at Kodiak knew that he was coming until the day before. And I didn't know until 2 days before. And the only other people that knew were the captain and the public works officer, because there were a lot of arrangements that had to be made about the station, you know, to move the president around while he was ashore. In fact, I got to thinking the captain was a little off his nut, because he was issuing orders and countermanding some other things that just didn't make good sense.
So this was before you knew he was coming?
Yes. Yeah. And finally, I think I guessed, or somebody guessed, that was the deal about an hour before I was told that he was coming.
Did he make any impression?
Yes. He was very sick at that time. But, and most of the time, he was just kind of droopy in a funk.
This is 1944?
Yes. And then, but when he'd start to talk to anybody, he'd brighten up. He was just the same sparkly person that you knew or had seen movies of before that time. And when he reviewed the troops, why, he was the same way. He sat up straight and waved and gave the famous Roosevelt smile. And he was a great guy. He couldn't keep that pace up, you know, all the time, but when it was important, he put on the act, as it were.
I think historically we've noted that during that period of time, he concealed really how bad his condition was from the American people, because we were still involved in the war, and most people didn't know that how badly deteriorated his condition was. What other experience can you tell us, Bob? There's one in the book that I think that the Taku adventure.
Well, that was in a sense it was an adventure, and in a sense it was a little humorous. I had landed at Tulsacaw, which is in Canada. And while I was there, a man came down the river in a boat and said, there's a big forest fire up the river. And so the provincial policeman says, I need your airplane to take some people up the river. And I wasn't too keen about the idea. And he says, it's a good spot to land. So we went up there, and it certainly wasn't a good spot to land. The current was very swift. And after looking it over carefully, I decided I could make it. And I got down all right, but In those days, we didn't have water rudders on the airplane, and they were a little hard to manage on the water, particularly in the river. And I got it into the river bank, and the mechanic was on the float with a line, and I jumped off the wing onto the bank and grabbed the line, and I couldn't hold the airplane. The current was that swift. So there it went downriver, around out of sight. And boy, I was...
Was anybody in it?
Yeah, all the firefighters and the flight mechanic.
Oh.
And after a while, I heard the motor start up, and he had... I made 2-3 starts, you know, but you had to get the airplane pointed precisely up current and then start the motor and get away fast. So here he came plowing around the bend in great style, and he put it on a little sandbar, much better of a job than I had done, and he had a guy, a river rat, standing on the float with a line, and who stepped to the side and walked around the prop and tied it to a big log up on the beach and waved okay, and so he shut off the engine, and down the river it went again. The guy had forgot to tie the line to the airplane. So of course, now I had company. But the next guy he had to point him upstream wasn't nearly as good, and it seemed like there was start after start after start before he finally did show up. And the next time he didn't do quite as good job, he put it, stuck the wing into the trees on the bank, but we raced down and decided it wasn't too bad a job. So then the patrolman said, well, this is no place. Let's take everybody out of here. That fire is still miles away. And I said, no, I'm going out of here empty. I can't take this load off in this kind of a... So we left them all there and took off empty and sent a riverboat up to them, pick them out of the woods several days later sometime. I don't know.
Bob, tell us a little bit about seaplane flying in Southeastern. And one thing we sort of skipped that newer generations won't understand or will forget about now, that there's an airport in Ketchikan. They couldn't build an airport in Ketchikan, so they built one on Annette Island.
Yes.
And by they, the government did?
Yes.
When was this, and at what cost, and that kind of thing? And
it was started in 1940, and, you know, I don't remember what the cost was, but it was quite a bit, because they had to put it right on top of Muskeg, and they weren't too skilled at that time on building airports on top of Muskeg.
And this was how far from Ketchikan, 20 miles?
21 miles, yes. And so we developed quite a traffic ferrying people from Ketchikan to the airport as the airport was developed, particularly after the war.
Ellis Airlines would meet the passengers who landed at Annette and fly them like a limousine service over to Ketchikan.
Yes.
And what aircraft did you use for that?
The Grumman Goose. See, we could land right on the field with that. Mm. And, there were days when we hauled as many as 200 passengers down there. With an 8-passenger airplane, that's quite a few trips.
Now, earlier in the show, and Sonny questioned you about this, you said you didn't like flying out of Anchorage very much, and you mentioned the Alaska Range. Well, I would think that flying in Southeastern would, through the mist, the fog, in that waterway, would be as hazardous as anything a pilot could be doing up here, isn't it?
I think it's largely in what you are used to. And I was used to it and familiar with the hazards. And when I came up to this country here, I'd heard a lot about the pilots up here and how brave and courageous and what kind of weather they flew in. And I was trying a little too hard. And I remember once I met Robbie at McGrath when we were both to fly back through Rainy Pass to Anchorage. And he had in separate airplanes. And he said, remember now, we don't fly in bad weather. And I said, yes. So when we got to the Alaska Range, it was really bad. But I had to eat each guy's flying this all the time. And And I was leaving because I'd been through, I was experienced. I'd been through Rainy Pass maybe six times by that time. But he'd never been through it. And boy, he just, I didn't even get out of the airplane here at Anchorage before he came over and yanked the door open. And I thought he was going to beat me up. He was so darn mad. We never fly in that kind of weather. So I said, I thought you flew in that kind all the time. But not so.
Any other techniques related to seaplane flying that in Southeastern?
Oh, yeah, and landings and takeoffs.